Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and you are listening and watching The Leadership Enigma, a globally ranked podcast where we're going to delve into the human being as well as the human doing. And trust me, you do not want to miss this particular episode because I have got the wonderful Stevie Ward that I almost met by accident. And Stevie is a former professional rugby player, part of the golden generation of the Leeds Rhinos, one of the most successful Super League teams in history. He became one of the youngest players of the grand final, and he went on to win two more grand finals and two Channing Cups and was named captain at Wakefield at just 26. That's crazy, isn't it? Had 10 operations along the way, but as I say to you, we're really going to delve into the human being side of things because a brain injury also forced him to step away from rugby in his prime. But he's doing some incredible work right now and helping so many people. Trust me, you do not want to miss this particular episode of the show. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and welcome to The Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. Stevie, thank you so much for coming down from Leeds to the Leadership Enigma.
Thanks for having me, mate. Yeah, I'm buzzing. Glad to be here.
Now, I hope that introduction was okay. It's whet the appetite of anyone watching and listening. And you and I listened. You and I met by accident, didn't we?
Yeah. Yeah, we ran into each other, didn't we?
Literally.
Well, I ran into your talk and loved it. And I was like, I want to speak to this person after. And I felt like a little bit of a, you know, when you, I just have that feeling when you're hanging around and you think, oh, I want to speak to this bloke. But you're like, am I a 12-year-old at my favourite band's concert here waiting to see if I can get a signature? But it was lovely, wasn't it?
That's
lovely
high praise chat. Indeed. I might just stop there, actually. It's good to go. Yeah. So no, we did meet by accident and immediately I heard your story, which resonated because I'm absolutely fascinated and insatiably curious about the human being as well as the human doing.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people will focus on the doing because you've had an incredible career as a professional sportsman with the Leeds Rhinos, captain, grand final winner, you know, huge crowds, massive, all those things that go with being a top professional sports player. But that's not really just what we wanted to talk about. We wanted to talk about the journey that you have been on and the journey that you continue on as well.
Yeah.
So can I just put things into context and just ask, rugby is very much at the heart maybe of the story, but when did rugby first become part of your life?
I think, mate, when rugby started to become part of my life, it was when I was just round at a childminder's. My mum and dad were motorbike enthusiasts. They met on a biking rally. My dad's from Salford.
We're getting clues already now, aren't we?
Yeah. So there was a collision there in terms of, you know, of worlds and was brought up in Leeds. So naturally I got into rugby league and I was remember being at my childminders. Next door there was some lad older than me who was playing with rugby ball. I'm like, what's that? And then I ended up going down to the amateur club just down the road. And mate, vivid memories of what it was like, the feeling of the leather touching my hands and feeling this ultimate, I guess, fear, trepidation, but at the same time, full acceptance and intensity for what was about to happen or what could happen.
Mate, and
I remember the feeling of it, like gravitating towards the defensive line of what in my mind were big angry men that want to grab me, throw me to ground and smash me to bits, you know?
That's going to put me off straight away, by the way, Steve.
Yeah, a lot of people just say, I'm not doing that, but something in me was drawing me towards this line, guiding me towards this line, and I don't know what it was, but I followed it, and all of a sudden I'd like veer towards my right, I'd shape my body up towards the skies, and before time ran out, I'd stamp my right foot down, and I'd cut into the line. And I always sort of explain this moment in my talks is vulnerability.
Right.
Because it's the ultimate vulnerability. When you're at that line, when you're in the teeth of it, just like in life, you can get sat on your ass or you can sort of pour through to the other side of the line.
Mm-hmm.
And mate, there's so many moments I can remember my hips moving out of these arms, trailing at my waist and these fingernails trying to scrag me back. And But there'd be this moment where you'd pop through to the other side, you'd feel your weight transfer to the other side. And then as a young lad, you'd hear your mum from the touchline screaming, "Go on, Stevie!" You know?
Gotta love our parents.
Oh, mate, and it's just full, that for me, that'd be full connection. Full, what I talk about now, authenticity.
Yeah.
And I'd be full of this creativity.
How old were you when you started to feel?
Eight, 9 years old.
So really young.
Six, I started.
Okay.
And, you know, ultimately, mate, it's the moments like that are built up on top of each other. And that's what it was for me. That it was full intensity and full acceptance of everything.
From such an early age.
From such an early age.
And what age were you where it started to appear that rugby could be something you could be very, very good at?
I think it was pretty much then. I knew in primary school I was going to be a rugby league player.
Like, okay.
And I always, I need to do my education because I might, you know, get a brain injury. Oh. I always knew that it was, that was the thing, but I also knew I was always going to be a rugby league player from year three, year four.
And home was Leeds, is that right?
Leeds, yeah.
No, originally Leeds. Okay, so yeah. we'll come on to Leeds Rhinos yeah. itself. Mm-hmm. When did you turn professional?
16.
See, that's young as well, isn't it?
I full-time at 17, signed a contract at 16.
With
Leeds? Yeah, I was at Leeds from 12 as well on the scholarship and stuff like that, so
okay,
straight into it.
Now, lots of people always draw a comparison with professional sport with leadership, and obviously our focus is leadership. Just help people understand a little bit about Leeds Rhinos and just where they sit in the hierarchy of rugby, because it's... you describe.
Yeah, mate, obviously, I was lucky to be part of the second, the golden generation, sort of the second half of that,
yeah,
and be around it most of my life. I played with the childhood heroes that I looked up to growing up, which was surreal.
Right.
You know, Rob Burrow, Kevin Sinfield, Jamie Peacock, Danny Maguire, Jamie Jones-Buchanan, all these people that England internationals, captains that had won 8 grand finals, 9 grand finals, and I'm growing up around these people immersed in this world.
Yes.
But we're talking that they, at that time, was the most successful team in Super League and also World Club champions. So they'd beaten the Australian champions, and the NRL is the Australian version of the competition,
yeah,
and even more grand than the Super League. So, yeah, mate, world-class players I was playing in and training with from 16 and then made my debut in 18. And, you know, these are players that sort of become immortal in terms of reputation and status, and I shared a lot of my life, shared friendships, shared fields with these blokes, and did battle for most of my life, really. And I'm incredibly grateful for it, and learned a lot about myself along the way as well.
Tell me a little bit about the strength of influence or even mentorship of that older squad of players, many of which you've just spoken about. We're going to come back to some of those. What influence did they have on you in relation to nurturing, mentoring, and just bringing you into what is a high-performing team on a global stage? Because let's help people understand this. You're playing in front of packed stadiums, televised, and part and parcel of the national news, if not international news. That's a lot for a 16, 17, 18-year-old.
Yeah.
How are you doing that, and what help are you getting from the old guard? Who aren't that old, let's be honest.
Yeah, mate. It was surreal because I'm coming into the change rooms and every leader had something different to offer.
Right.
There's Jamie Peacock, who was a prop forward, so does most of the grunt work, who would openly admit that he would try and hurt the opposing number more than they hurt him.
Right.
So he was an enforcer type.
It's gladiatorial.
It is gladiatorial. And then this is like Kevin Sinfield, who was more the tactician, more methodical, cool as a cucumber somehow. And I never sort of understood that. And James Jones-Buchanan, who was this back row workhorse who would be a man of God and would be reading out sermons sometimes in and around the change rooms before games. And just a clash of personalities, oddballs. But there's a golden thread that I sort of pulled throughout my career growing up, and also what I sort of aligned with at times during my career to sort of understand how did we win two grand finals as underdogs from fifth place when everyone was writing us off not to do it? How did we win a treble, so three trophies in the same year, when no one expected us
like
to be able
Man
to do
City.
It? Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like,
it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. And there was a lot of pain. There was a lot of triumph in and around it. But there's also a moment where I won a grand final 6 days after dislocating a shoulder. And in and around my career, I got to this point. I was like, what is it? What are we talking about here? What is it that we
can
do?
Can you put a finger on it?
For me, and the closest label that I can put to it is authenticity.
Okay.
That's
what do you mean by that when you talk about it in a team context?
When I talk about it in a team context, my mission now, mate, is to enable people to feel brave enough and safe enough to be themselves. So that means ridiculously amounts of high level of safety, psychological safety,
yep.
But also courage at the same time.
Personal courage.
Personal courage, yeah, I'd say so. That moment of being younger, and this is leadership for me. This is, we can go off in Storyland and talk all about concepts and labels and stuff, but I already was a leader before the idea of what leadership was got in the way,
okay.
If that makes sense. The fundamental part of leadership was me being 10-year-old on a rugby league field. When you're 10 minutes in, one of their team has put one of your teammates on their ass. Your team's made a few mistakes, you're 10 minutes in. And there's this feeling of fear. There's this like thinking, I don't know if I want to be here. There's this sort of like pondering for what do you do in this moment?
Right.
The moment of leadership for me always was the ability to look at the person with the ball and to look him in the eyes and scream, give me that fucking ball. That's what leadership was for me, because I didn't know what was going to come from that moment. I had no idea. I just had the courage, the acceptance of anything that could happen, and the intensity to ask for the ball.
Where's that coming from at such a young age, Stevie?
I've no idea. I've no idea. I think there's things I could give you that would explain what my life was like. You know, I used to stream to the bottom of the street from where I lived, and on a BMX, and took off on a ramp that my dad had made in the garage. And I also used to walk into my living room at times, and my mum would come home from work, and she had tough upbringing, my mum. And she had a pretty difficult job, and you know, I'd come home from school and I'd walk into the living room and she'd have like this ruminating, stressed and worried face on her.
Right.
And, you know, she lived with depression quite a lot, my mum. And I'd sort of walk in and be like, I wouldn't know what to do or to handle things. I wouldn't know how to express myself. So I'd probably depress stuff. And in a way, I would sort of saying the safest thing for me to do in that moment, I guess, was to say, well, not what's wrong with my mum, like, oh, what's wrong with me? So I believe and sort of see that those defensive lines that I sort of built within myself, any outlet of rugby league when it was full intensity, going and watching my favourite band when it was full intensity, emotion, absolute, all out, everything, all out authenticity, that's for me where I was drawn to. And that's the best I can say, really.
I love to have these conversations because I'm also assuming that you don't comprehend that at 10, 11, 12 years old, but
No. These
are probably things that you've started to think about now, later on in life. And let's be honest, you're still young. But are these things now you're trying to unpick and understand more now, especially in the current climate of your life phase?
Yeah, 100%. And to sort of answer the question about authenticity, like the journey I'm on now and the journey that I invite people on at the moment is what I believe authenticity to be, and it's not becoming something you think you're supposed to be. It's not becoming something you think you're supposed to be.
Mm.
It's actually allowing yourself to unfold into what you already are. And I look at that through the lens of realizing that golden thread at moments in my career. When I was 8 operations in, when I had a concussion, when I'm looking back and there's been loads of change at the club, there's a new coach come in, loads of your teammates have left, you've lost about 4 or 5 on the bounce, and you sat there and you're scared,
mm-hmm.
you're terrified really, because you're thinking, are we going to win? Are we going to win this week? What are we going to do to win? And then they score a try, and then all of a sudden you're in that cycle. I managed to get back to that thread at times, asking, what can I bring? Why am I needed? You know? And it took me back to that anecdote that I mentioned about running towards the line, mm-hmm. about hearing my mum from the touchline and feeling the freedom on the other side of that line. It's like, oh, that's why I'm here. None of the stuff that everyone's telling me that I should be here for, none of the stuff that sounds good to be here is what I'm here for. It's the heart, it's the courage.
So you felt entirely authentic on the pitch to express yourself in a way that...
At times, not all the time.
So when you come back to the Leeds Rhinos and you talked about you had quite a diversity of personality on there, and let's be honest, diversity of thought and just diversity mm. generally, if you can harness it, is incredibly yeah. powerful. But you think it was the ability of those players to be themselves truly, mm. but also as a unit, that made you a championship winning side. Yeah. Have I summarising that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you totally are. And I speak to players that I played against at times, and they'll talk, that team you had, it's just like, he said, you weren't bothered about the game plan.
Did it overperform?
I think at times you underperformed, if I'm honest.
Right.
And what I'm getting at is, I think when we watch sport and when we watch a team, a football team, a rugby team or whatever, and we see them blow the other team off the field.
Yeah.
The commentators are usually, they're going to go, oh, they took the shackles off of this one, you know? Mm. And when we're in the team, we're like, we just felt free there. Just felt free. So the questions I ask, whether it's leadership or teamwork, I'm like, well, what are the shackles?
Real or perceived?
Yeah. What are we free from? And they're all perceived, because I think the shackles are not necessarily the fear, because in those moments when I was young, when I screamed for the ball, I was full of fear. But it's the responses to fear. It's the response to not scream for the ball. It's the response to conform, to control, to coerce, to critique, to be cynical, to overshare, to explain, to move away from the core. Which is funny, actually, I say that from, because that's where courage comes from, the old Latin, which is heart. It's the response to move away from heart.
Okay.
Wearing a heart on the sleeve, you know.
I find this conversation fascinating all the time, because people, I think, are also interested in what makes a high-performing team, and there's much written about that, but you're actually talking about it at quite a visceral level.
Mm.
What did it really feel like to be at the heart of it?
Yeah.
Help me understand what it was like to be put into an official leadership role, because you were named captain at just 26 of the Leeds Rhinos, this super successful team.
Mm.
What did that feel like to officially be, you're the captain?
I think, mate, I'd captained 24 a few times at 24. And I was at that stage, 24, 25, it was a lot of, am I officially going to be captain here? Or expecting it? And
yeah.
Anyway, I'd not been, and someone else got captaincy, and they got injured. So I'd come in, and the team was struggling. And there's moments, mate, where I completely crippled under the pressure.
Of the label of captain.
Of the label of captain, of the perceived responsibility of what right. captain was, of what I thought I should be as a captain.
On game day, or
I think it was before it was more on game day. I remember flying over to France at Catalans, and I was 24, I was captain, and we'd not won for quite a few games, and we were struggling as a team. And go over to France. The hotel wasn't great, and I didn't sleep. And coming out into the game the next day, and I just felt like, I just felt overwhelmed, completely overwhelmed.
Right.
And there was too much thinking. There was too much thinking.
Right.
In what was going on for me, and this is the thing. I don't feel like, as a sport, as human beings, we're at the place where we understand this dynamic enough.
Right.
And yeah, mate, I saw that was a big, was terrible in the game. I probably played the worst game that I'd played in professional rugby. And then the next game, I was pretty decent. I was fairly good. We won a Challenge Cup game to like the rugby league version of the FA Cup.
And right.
Sort of got back on the horse and was there again. So whenever I'm looking about performance or what it means,
yeah.
I'm always like, well, let's not add anything. We don't need to add anything. It's about taking things away to get back to that
authenticity.
That authenticity.
Right. Do you know why you were given the captaincy? Did they ever say to you, we want you to be the captain because, was that ever explained to you, or were you just given the weight of the role?
I guess it wasn't overly explained at the point. I think the season before, I'd led some leadership meetings with the team because we were terrible. Like we'd just won the grand final the 2 years before, been shocking in 2018. Had a new coach come in, and then 2019.
Yeah,
it's like right, this is it. We're gonna. And then it was like 8-9 games we'd not won. And I remember sitting in a video review, and the coach who had just come in at the time was, this is funny, actually it goes back to the whole point of the podcast. He's bringing up, in the video review, he's bringing up the review of the game against Bradford Bulls in the Challenge Cup, where we got like knocked out when it was a really big upset.
Right.
And he's bringing up knock-ons, so I was dropping the ball, missed tackles, and I'm just sat through the video, and I'm just like, why is he bringing this up? Like, looking around and thinking, what does this have to do with any of it?
Mm.
And it's just the outcome. This is what we're doing from who we're being. You know, and literally, he said, "Oh, Stevie, what do you think? You've been here for a long time. What do you think?" And I remember just saying, "I wasn't playing at the time. I had a knee injury, and I was up in the stands watching. And I just said, look, fellas, this is hard for me to say because I didn't play and I didn't go into the battle with you. But I felt sick watching it. I felt sick to the stomach. I was looking at the field." And I was just, we've all got different expectations of what it looks like. We've all got different game plans in our head. All got different standards of who we are. And I remember this moment, mate. I was sat in there and I was like thinking about a moment of when I was 10 years old playing for a team called Cherwell Chiefs.
Right.
And I'd been handed down the rites of passage from my head coach at the time, 10 years old. And you know, when you have the huddle at the start of the game, it's like 1-2-3 Warriors or 1-2-3 Raiders or, well, ours was different. I used to scream the question to my team, who are we?
Right.
And the full team would go, Joel. And I'd go, who are we? And the full team, Joel. And I'm just sat there in that video room at that moment. I'm like, who are we? We don't know who we are. We've got someone who's coming from Tonga, from Papua New Guinea.
Lack of identity.
Just a total lack of being, yeah. Everything comes from who we're being.
Yeah.
Like, everything comes from who we're being. The doing is just a symptom of that, you know?
What do you think was the differentiator? Because you've got a whole variety of players, as you say, national, international players, all with different personalities, outlooks, aspirations, capabilities. So it's a real melting pot. Mm. What's the big difference then between that group of people being a grand final winning team and that group of people being a team that's just not
hitting the mark and losing and losing and losing. What's the difference?
For me, I think it's what we do around fear. I think it is. I think we was in that moment. I mentioned the psychological safety, right? All the time we're asking as human beings, all the time. And coming in here is great because I've hardly even asked it. But we're asking, am I safe here? Am I enough? Am I valued? Can I make a mistake? Can I tell the truth? And ultimately, can I give everything? And there's so much uncertainty, especially in a rugby league team, because of the heightened masculinity, the lengths you have to go to. There's this uncertainty about, can I do this move here? Can I make a mistake? Can I be me?
Right.
You know? And I think if there's not vulnerability, which is uncertainty, risk and emotional exposure.
Yeah.
Which pretty much is courage. You are not going to be able to go into these games and be everything and give everything.
Do you think that was the differentiator? I think that's the piece. Because the talent's there.
Yeah.
But that the piece is missing.
100%.
We must see this all the time with football teams, with cricket teams, with any team, that if a team is underperforming, overperforming, whatever, what is the differentiator? And what I'm hearing from you is that you think it's the ability for people to be courageous within a psychologically safe environment and be themselves and make mistakes.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether you've unpacked it in that way before, because that's interesting.
Might be a new tagline.
As we can compare and contrast. Mm. Do you think that was also down to the manager, the coaching staff at the time, who allowed that, helped build the psychological safety?
100%. 100%. And he'd be the first to admit that he wasn't perfect. It's Brian McDermott, who I think he's the most successful Super League coach to date.
Yeah.
Was tasked of managing these players that had already won X amount before he got there.
There's an expectation.
There's massive expectation.
Yeah.
And also, the brutal truth of it is, like, how do you get these players to run through brick walls just as much as they did 5 years ago before they'd won anything?
Yeah.
You know? And this is where I believe the heart comes in, the courage comes into it, and what I deem as the authenticity game plan. Because in rugby, you can play it where, well, you can carry it out. You can carry rugby out as a prescription instead of playing rugby. And I don't know about you, but whenever I've been told or prescribed or told to carry anything out, I'm hardly there. I'm not really fully there.
It doesn't feel authentic.
Doesn't feel authentic.
Okay.
So at times, you know, rugby teams are given, get to this post and you're going to put a lovely move on that does this and that. You have to be exactly at this moment in time in this position, and this is your role. So you run into the post and get your head kicked in for the half back.
For the greater good.
Exactly, yeah.
Sacrifice yourself. Amen.
Yeah, thank you. I will take that on.
Godspeed.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
So that's, you know, all strategic and brilliant. No, there's a plan. But I think where the edge came for us, or where we were brought alive, is the fact that, and I truly believe this, to encourage someone, you have to be encourage yourself in uncertainty and feel the full fear, as you would as if you were catching the ball, to be in a group of men, but say things where you're asking people to hold the nerve. I don't know what we're going to come up with here, but we'll come up with something. And he used to say things like, to win this game, you're going to have to surprise yourselves just as much as you surprise the opposition. And a lot of people will be listening to this thinking, fuck, I'm not, what do you mean? We're going into a grand final or we're going into a semi-final? Like, we need to know what's going to work.
Yeah.
Tell us the move. But there's this trust, there's safety, and you go, I wonder if 8-year-old Stevie Waugh is going to come out today.
It's almost trust the process.
Trust, just trust
let it go.
Just let it all go.
That's fascinating. It always gives me tingles in a way of trying to unpick and uncover. This is what this podcast is all about.
I love it too, mate.
You know, this, and maybe this is a slightly different conversation that we're having. You know, we chatted earlier that you've done many podcasts, you've done many interviews, you're on Sky News a lot, etc. Yeah. So I want us to have a deeply personal conversation. And I know you've thought about this a lot, because I want to move to the fact that, you know, you've spent your career, you've always been passionate, want to be a rugby player, you become a professional player at the highest level, captain at 26, final after final after final. And then a brain injury has forced you to step away in your prime. Just help everybody understand what happened, which then meant you had to go into a completely different chapter in your life.
Well, I mean, yeah, the obviously concussion's quite the big thing at the moment in sport, and I'd played a couple of games at the start of the year when I was captain at 26, and I'd picked up two brain injuries, really, 2 weeks apart. And after the second game, I felt like I was on Mars a little bit, in terms of, like, imagine spacey and shocking migraine, dizziness, and obviously, like, what is going on? What we're now 4.5 years down the line, and I'm still feeling the effects of it. I'm still feeling the dizziness, vertigo type stuff, and also the headaches every day, really.
Right.
And what's it brought me to? What's that brought me to? I think it's brought me to a place of actually trusting myself more, funny enough.
Right.
The self-trust wavered for many moments in my life.
How must it felt when the thing you loved and you're really good at gets taken away?
Oh, mate, it was a version of death, really.
Right.
I've grieved the truth of it is, I've deeply grieved for the past 3-4 years, and for a year I wasn't really facing up to it.
Right.
And understanding myself more and more, which is I've just had to do, and trust myself and accept myself over the last few years, is understanding that I'm deeply sensitive as a man,
and vulnerable,
like
all of us,
exactly. And that sensitivity was what I realized was being able to do those things on the field, creating, surprising yourself, were the creativity that comes with it. But also, when you thwart that sensitivity, the ability to feel, that's when anxiety comes.
How was the decision come to that you had to step away from rugby?
6 months in, and the writing was on the wall. I was just like, it's not progressing. Yeah. And then it took me a few months to, all right, yeah, this is actually something that I'm going into here and I have to do.
And what was the kind of support from the medical team of the Leeds? And
I'd basically gone on to speak to all sorts of specialists and understanding,
yes,
what's going on, and basically what we came from it was I was diagnosed with migraineous concussion and vestibular, so that means that I'm getting migraine and they can't really explain why. And there's my inner ear is dysfunctional,
right.
So that's where the vertigo and stuff comes from.
Dizziness and
it was about trying to settle my nervous system down enough to be able to train and work on the vestibular stuff, and there's obviously been a whole journey of that, and obviously the documentary is out of undertaking that. And
just help everyone understand the documentary you're referring to.
Yeah, it's Sky Sports documentary. I did it in the thick of it. I think I did it about 6 to 8 months in. And I've always done this, and I don't know why, but I've always felt the need to share stuff as I go, and share what's happening and what it looks like. And
it's quite a courageous decision, because I have watched elements of the documentary. Mm. You and Sky Sports, you actually didn't know how this was going to turn out.
No,
you? You had no idea how this documentary was going to unfold.
I was doing it hoping that they'd catch up with me in a few months' time and I'd be fully better, you know?
Right.
That I was like putting my mind, I'm going to get better. I'm going to do the document. It's going to be, I'm going to show that you can, well, get better from this stuff. And
I'm going to just stop on the documentary, because I know that you went back to Leeds Rhinos, didn't you?
Yeah.
For a match. And that must have been slightly surreal for you, watching as the team run out in front of a stadium full of people. And you left, I think, in the first half, didn't you? Just explain to people what was going on for you as you went back to the stadium and had that experience.
It was, and it's still with me now, the sensory overload, I guess, the noise, which is the biggest thing. And we was on the gantry where they do the cameras and stuff, just above the south stand, which is the notoriously loud part of
you
the stadium.
Actually, the noise was almost overwhelming for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was way too much. And obviously, I'm going down doing this Sky Sports thing and just showing people into what I used to do, my experience being there and stuff. And it was one of those moments where I was like, do I stick this out here? Or is it, because my migraine was a triggered migraine. I'm like, what's the point in me being here watching the rest of this game when I'm not well, you know? So yeah, that was a moment, mate, where I'd come away from what was going on for me and just felt like, this isn't doing me any good, you know.
Right.
You know, and mate, there's probably a load of emotional stuff in there as well, you know. Like, my career had ended on that field about 7-8 months earlier, and I was captain for Rob Burrow's game when he came on with motor neurone disease, and and I'd gone there from being 10 years old watching a load of my team. It was like,
wow. Everything you'd known.
A lot, yeah. Passionate. A lot, yeah.
You just mentioned there Rob Burrows. And again, just help people understand who Rob Burrows is and the journey and story of Rob Burrows. Because we have lots of people internationally as well who watch and listen. Just help people understand.
Well, Rob was one of my good mates in the team. And I remember an instant connection after watching him as a young kid, just being absolutely in awe of him.
Hmm.
He was the smallest player, I think, to play any type of contact game, but one of the best, and an absolute like champion of a player, but as a man who truly cared about his family, who truly sort of valued them, and had a good relationship with the game, and didn't get too lost in it. That's what I always respected about Rob, and made me laugh more than anyone, really.
Because you're one of the young players coming through the system at the time.
Yeah, and obviously Rob had this incredible career. The 2017 Grand Final was his last game. And then two years after that, or not even 2 years, I think a year and a half, he'd been diagnosed with motor neurone disease, which... Yeah,
this was a national story.
Yeah, this has picked so much coverage and support because of who he was and how obviously devastating motor neurone disease is. And I was there for the game when he came on for obviously the announcement. And it just feels absolutely crazy thinking about it, you know. And a load of the ex-players had come back for a friendly. It'd been a testimonial game devised for Rob after the announcement of motor neurone disease, and then obviously the years that followed that, which is probably long. Well, I know it's a lot longer than he got given to live, and many visits going around to his house, going around to his mum's and dad's, and just being with him and just going around with some of the other teammates and laughing and joking and taking mick out of Rob, taking mick out of each other. And but yeah, I felt it deeply, I think, with Rob, especially around the diagnosis. I think for 2 weeks I was just in bits, absolutely in bits. But I think I think what he's done in terms of coverage for the disease and the inspiration he's given to millions of people is, well, I mean, he's had two lives really, in a way. You know, he's done it on the rugby field, but then he's done it with that disease. So, he was... weird saying he was, still weird saying he was, but he was one of those people that when you're young, you come into a team like that and you're feeling scared and nervous and not, he always made you feel safe, you know.
We're coming back to that theme of safety, aren't we?
Yeah.
Listen, I know this is difficult for you. I really appreciate, you know, we can have that conversation. Actually, you feel safe to have that conversation. We haven't known each other that long, so it's important. And I know we were in contact with each other, weren't we? And you were actually at his funeral. So he passed quite recently, and you were at that. What does that legacy really now mean to you in really what you're trying to do in helping as many people as possible as regards courage, vulnerability, mental health, men being able to speak up about some of the issues? Has that given you something that you can take forward?
I think it's given me... there's always been a lot of fear around talking about what I believe and what I know to be true. Because I guess I played in one of the toughest sports that there is. You know, most masculine, to talk about psychological safety and authenticity, and
the two don't quite go.
It's like, what are you talk safe? What are you talking about? Or authenticity? Like, what? But I also believe it's like, it's not. We're not just talking about performance. We're not just talking about a nice to do. I think it's fundamental to us as human beings, especially with health. You know, and like I said earlier about moments in my life where I felt like I had to depress stuff instead of expressing it.
Right. You mentioned that at a very young age.
Yeah.
With what you were, saw your mother going through.
And that's why I talk so openly, because I feel like authenticity, and I know it is from Gabor Marte's work. He's an incredible physician, a Canadian physician who's done so much work on trauma and addiction, like on how important it is to, because we're so used in life being tied to attachment for safety, we lose all of the ability to express ourselves and we lose that authenticity. And I'm the stuff with Rob and what's happened with me, I'm fully there to explore it. Do you know what I mean? I don't have any grand things that I want to tick off.
You're still on a journey,
yeah,
Stevie, and it's a challenging one and a rewarding one. Let me ask you these questions. As Stevie Ward, the captain of Leeds Rhinos, what would be almost your number one leadership lesson that you would want to share with people as a leader of a team, of a high performing winning team? Is there a standout piece of leadership advice that you'd want to share?
Ooh. I'm going to go with something from David White, who was a poet, actually.
Go on.
and he says take the first step, and that not necessarily is the step out onto the ground into whatever you're doing. It's like take the first step down into who you are And usually it's the stuff that you know to be true, that you know to be the your voice. Basically, it's your voice and not smothered by other people's voice.
Okay.
I think that has to, if we're talking about leadership, a lot of it is being able to ask for the ball and not know what's going to happen. And I know that the best players, the ones that achieved more than me, they were able to do that more than I could, and more than most could. I think that is the biggest thing. And I think studying your relationship to fear is probably the most, well, I know it is the most powerful thing that you can do.
And is that coming from Stevie Ward, the captain of the Leeds Rhinos, or is that now coming from Stevie Ward, the human being who has had,
I think it's
this 4 years worth of experience on top of?
Yeah, I think it's coming from what I would have said, if I dare say it, as a captain of Leeds Rhinos,
okay,
as well, but also me now.
That's who you are, right?
Yeah.
Listen, this has been an incredible conversation. I lighten the mood slightly because I'm deeply grateful for you coming from Leeds all the way into London for us to have this conversation. I saw a couple of interesting did you know things we're going to talk about. You know we are.
I shouldn't have put them on the website, should I?
You did, so it's fair game. That's how it works, Stevie. One of them is your part and parcel of a Boy George song.
Yeah.
You're going to have to tell us about that.
Yeah, that was mental. That was mental. I think I was... This is linked to the injury, actually. I was travelling and I'd gone for some treatment and stuff like that, and I was over in Costa Rica, I think, and he'd sent me a message just of his new song.
Yeah.
And he says, I think you'll like it. I'm
like, oh, why? Had you met Boy George at the
point? I'd met him, yeah. Okay. Mate, 2016, I'd first met him or whatever. He sent me the song. It's called Humanize. It's a pretty good song, actually. But there's a lyric in the chorus. It's talking about fireworks being in Stevie's head.
Right.
And I'm like, what is
And that's going? You.
Yeah, obviously, yeah. That's the fireworks of the headaches and stuff like that. I'm like, oh, my God. How has that happened? How is that? You know when you think, when you're expecting your career, you go, what's just happened there?
Yeah.
I'd just had a pretty cool friendship with him for years.
Yeah.
Asked him about the speaking and performing and all the rest of it. And obviously there's not many people that he did ask me to wear a hat at one point. I'm like, oh, I'm not sure I'm at the hat point yet. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Boy, George Jamiroquai is about
it. yeah, exactly. But inspirational guy. And we have the biggest, widest ranging, most, diverse conversations you can imagine.
Still in touch?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's super cool. And there's another one as well, is, and I watched this video too, is that you got roasted by Ricky Gervais in a video. Now, I think contextually, you'd reached out through someone for him to do something for Rob Burrows at the time, which he did, but he gave you a damn good kicking off the back of it. Is that right?
He nailed me. Absolutely nailed me. And
if anyone's seen it, I'll put the link of it in the show notes for this.
Literally, I remember sending a message about 2 days before and, you know, sending a few different people. The first one I messaged, Ben Michel from the Times, he messaged saying, I think we've got someone here.
Yeah.
That was when I was at training. I'd gone home, finished training, gone for a nap, and then woke up after the nap.
Reached out to James
O'Brien.
James O'Brien.
Ben Michel messaged James O'Brien.
And I went, well, no, not really. I've interviewed him a couple of times and we get on pretty well in those sort of scenarios, but he doesn't invite me around for Sunday lunch. And he said, well, can you get a message to him? And I said, yeah, I can, oddly enough. We swapped occasional messages. I said, why? Because I don't know him well enough to ask for a favour. And he said, well, do you know Rob Burrow? And I said, yeah, of course I do. And Rob is the former Leeds Rhinos player who's got motor neurone disease and has just moved mountains to bring motor neurone disease to a much bigger audience. And he said, well, he's a massive Ricky Gervais fan. Do you think you could get Ricky to record him a little message or something like that?
Because James,
this journalist, is friends with a guy called Stevie Ward, who was the captain of Leeds Rhinos and is a great friend, obviously, of Rob Burrows. So I dropped Ricky a note, not thinking he'd even reply. And you have to do that thing where you say, oh, please don't worry about replying. I know you must get asked stuff like this all the time. Next morning, I turn my phone on and flipping it, he's gone, he's filmed it. He's recorded it himself.
All right, Rob. Your mate Stevie Ward got in contact and said you're a big fan. Thank you. And would I say a few words? Which is good of him. Or is it?
Or is it? It's the office now.
It's good of his nose, isn't it?
Or is it?
All right, mate. All right, Rick. Do us a favour, will you? Of course I will, Stevie. I've never met you. What do you need? Oh, would you say a few words? Does he know how fucking busy I am? So that's my job, isn't it? Saying stuff. That is my... Would I call up your mate Stevie and go, all right, Stevie, you're a rugby player. Will you come round to my garden and run round with a bollock-shaped ball for an hour? No, I wouldn't. So here's a few words. Tell your mate Stevie to keep his good ideas to himself in future, will you?
Cheers.
Cheers.
And that's the roasting.
I'd honestly woke up after a nap. Do you know when you nap for too long for 2 hours, and I was woke up knackered. I'm like, I thought I was in a dream. Honestly, I was like, what? And he's just roasting me to death.
Well, do you know what? I think if Ricky Gervais is watching or listening, which he isn't, Stevie, do you want to roast him back?
Oh, mate, I don't know. You have to give me more time. There was a moment. There was a moment where I said to Rob, we need to get back to this here. You know, initially when it happened. And I also say, look, yeah. I don't know what I'd say. I'd take up the offer and go play rugby league in his back garden.
Well, there you go. You've heard it here first.
I would do it. Needs a big garden, though. So that's...
All right, yeah. Well, Ricky Gervais, if you're watching or listening, we'll get a message to you. Stevie Ward is going to return the favour and he will run around your garden with an odd-shaped
not with
ball.
A bollock-shaped ball. I'm over that.
Listen, Stevie, it's been amazing to have you on the Leadership Enigma. Have you enjoyed this? Because I know you do a lot of these. And we talked earlier. We wanted to make this one a little bit special.
Loved it, mate. I always learn from coming and doing these and sort of going through my thoughts. And yeah, mate, loved it. Loved being with you. And loved being here, mate. Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure, and you and I will be doing more together because I know that you're really on a mission now to help as many people as possible.
Yeah.
Mentality is a podcast and program that you're running in order to help men with mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's something that is very, very real. And so anything we can do to help support that too as part of the Leadership Enigma is our absolute pleasure. Stevie, you've been an absolute star. Thank you so much for being part of this, and we will speak again. Join us again next week for more curiosity and insight with the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with me on LinkedIn or visit us at www.leadersenigma.com. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms and on our dedicated YouTube channel. Thanks again for joining the community.